Welcome all to the Contemporary Film Directors Podcast, sponsored by the University of Illinois Press. My name is Justice Nealand. I'm professor of English and Film Studies and chair of the Department of English at Michigan State University. And it's also my great pleasure to serve as co-editor of the CFD series. I've been working in that role with my beloved co-editor and dear friend, Professor Jennifer Fay, since 2012, when we took over from the series' founding editor, Jim Naremore. And Jen and I have published 23 volumes to date, including Shawnee's great book. So we're especially excited about this, our inaugural CFD podcast. In this series, we're going to have the chance to chat with our authors about new and forthcoming books in the series. And so we're delighted today to talk with the author of the latest CFD volume, hot off the press in August, on the British filmmaker Joanna Hogg. This is a smartly conceptualized, beautifully written book by our featured guest today, Shawnee Antelope. Jen and I are delighted to talk with Shawnee about her book, but also to introduce and welcome the new CFD series editors, Sarah Keller and Josh Umebe. So before we go any further, could I ask all of you to briefly introduce yourselves to our audience? Starting with Jim.
Hi, I'm Josh Umebe. I guess I'll jump in first. I'm Josh Umebe. I'm a professor of film studies and English with Justice at Michigan State University. And it's an absolute pleasure to collaborate with everybody on this series. I've always been like so amazed and by the work that's been put out through it, and have used it in my own classes. And so, to be able to come in and carry on the excellent work is an absolute privilege. So, thank you all.
Sarah.
I am Sarah Keller. I am a professor of art and art history and director of cinema studies at the University of Massachusetts Boston. And I could not be more thrilled to be taking up the thread already begun and woven so beautifully into a tapestry of amazingness by Justice and Jen as at the helm of the series. So I'm delighted to be here.
And I'm Jennifer Fay. I'm professor of English and Cinema and Media Arts at Vanderbilt University and chair of the Department of English. And I'll just say what an honor it's been to be co-editor with Justice on this series. I'm so proud of the work we've done and so excited for the work to come. And it's especially meaningful to me to be kind of rotating off this project with this book by Shawnee. This has been such a delight to read. Joanna Hogg is so richly deserving of a volume, and I feel like, Shawnee, you have found your kind of intellectual muse with Joanna's work. I'm going to invite Shawnee to, you can, if you want to introduce yourself, I know that you are a professor and now chair of English at Fordham University. If there's anything else you'd like to say, I invite you to introduce yourself, and then we'll we have a few questions for you.
Sure. Thank you so much to Jen and Justice and to Joshua and Sarah. It's an absolute honor to be an author in this extraordinary series. When I launched the book last month at the Museum of the Moving Image here in New York, the curator, Eric Hines, introduced the book by saying that this is the very best, you know, series on contemporary film. And he just, you know, it's wonderful to me not only to share in this, you know, durational project of the series, but also to have the book be a part of a series that is read so widely, both in and outside the academy. So it's just a really, I think it's a really special opportunity, and I'm delighted to be a part of it.
Well, we'd like to begin by just inviting you to talk about the origins of this project and a few ways of thinking about this, both how this work connects to your previous book on method acting and theories of the subject that emerge out of method acting, but also what attracted you specifically to Joanna Hogg, maybe through this intellectual framework.
Yes. absolutely. Thank you so much for that question. So this is one of these questions that I feel like the answer could be, you know, I could talk for like the next hour just about this. So you'll have to forgive me, but also stop me if I go on too long. So just to say by way of introduction, I work on performance across media in and after modernism. I teach drama and theater. I actually don't teach courses primarily on film. But I, you know, my PhD is in comparative literature. I teach in the English department. I teach courses that, you know, study works across media. But most of my work, and certainly all of my books, are about realist acting. My work on realist acting starts from the premise that rather than a niche topic, realist acting is a crucial aesthetic form of modernity, and that it has a lot to say about how we experience and represent subjectivity, and also that it has a lot to do with form. Literary form, theatrical form, cinematic form. So that's what brings together, you know, all my work, my previous work on method acting and drama in a U.S. context in the mid 20th century, and this project on Joanna Hogg, because Hogg's films have really helped me so much to think in new ways about realist acting, subjectivity, and form. So that's like the thread that links together these projects that might otherwise seem very different and that are very different in many ways as well. What drew me to Joanna Hogg? Oh my goodness. Okay. Well, it all started with The Souvenir, with the Joanna Hogg's first Souvenir film, which came out in 2019, and the breathtaking final moments of that film, when Honor Swinton Byrne, playing Julie, the main character, looks directly at the camera. I saw this film when it came out, It's difficult to describe the intensity of the emotional reaction I had to this film, and particularly to that moment. And I wanted to figure out why that moment felt so incredibly moving to me, like beyond what I can remember experiencing in cinema. Of course, part of it is that it's this very interesting moment where the acting breaks form. It breaks the so-called fourth wall. For the listeners, those were scare quotes that I just said. It breaks the realist enclosure of the scene. But I've seen plenty of films that do that. In fact, it's almost a cliche. You know, at this point, it's become kind of banal. So it wasn't just that. It wasn't just the sort of breaking of the realist enclosure. Part of what's moving about that moment is its location in the narrative of the film, right? The tragedy of the character's lover's death that's just happened, and the fact that we're sort of in the immediate wake of this incredible loss. But that, you know, didn't seem to exhaust it either. So this was the hook for me in thinking about all these questions about what's going on in the acting, how it relates to this experience I had as a spectator, and how that relates to the form of the film. And what I came to realize is that there was something going on in that moment that has to do with the film's autobiographical form, and this kind of excessive, I would say, autobiographical form of the film that I find really interesting as well. So, you know, I had all this in my head, and I was sort of playing, I wrote a little something for my friends at Reverse Shot about the film, where I was sort of playing with this idea of autobiography and the form of autobiography, and what's happening in this sort of theatricalizing of Hogg's autobiography. For those who don't know, the thing about the film, sort of famous thing about the film, is that it is autobiographical to an uncommon degree. Hogg used real letters from her lover. She gave the actor who played her lover, quote unquote, tapes of therapy sessions she'd had. There was a kind of extreme amount of autobiographical material that was included in this film. So I started to sort of think about how this moment when the actor looks at the camera related to this kind of excessive mode of theatricalized autobiography, where the filmmaker was staging her life in other bodies. So I had all this in my head, and at the same time, I was reading Joan Kopczak with my friends, Martin Harries and Julia Jarko, and we were actually doing it because we were thinking about the death drive for a seminar at a theater conference. But what I, you know, what I realized actually, it was Kopczak's reading of Michael Fried that got me to the central interlocutor in the book, and the central concept of the book, which is absorption. And what interested me so much was how Kopczak describes absorption as this kind of aesthetic demonstration of love that is what gives us, all of us, she thinks, you know, the corporeal experience of subjectivity. So for Kopczak, right, it's our attachment to an object outside ourselves that enables us to feel the flush of our subjectivity. So just on a, you know, on a like personal experiential level, I was like, oh, that's it. That's what I experienced when I watched this film. I had this flush of my own subjectivity and my attachment to this object outside myself. And then I was like, oh, and of course, that's what's happening narratively in the scene. And that's also what's happening formally and compositionally in this moment as, you know, the actor kind of looks at the other, the real other in the scene, which is the filmmaker. So that was sort of the, that for me was the kind of, you know, theoretical engine that led me to really try to theorize absorption and acting. Maybe I'll stop there.
Shawnee, I'm going to jump in, and your answer where you ended is sort of anticipating where I wanted to go, or hope we can go a little bit further. So one of the things that Jen and I try to do with the series is encourage authors to take more concept-forward approaches to any given director's body of work, and to kind of avoid a sort of plotting chronologically through a series of works. And you do that amazingly well. And you do it by setting up this powerful set of conceptual frames. And I think you've started to answer where I wanted to go with this, which was, did the Kopczak precede the Fried, or did the Fried precede the Kopczak? But it sounds like you came to Kopczak's ideas about attachment through Fried first, and then worked backwards into Fried's ideas about painterly absorption and the construction of a certain kind of beholder. So for those listening who may not be as aware of, you know, this very famous modernist art historian, Michael Fried, and his accounts of absorption, could you talk us through a little bit how that became such a powerful frame for thinking through Hogg's work?
Yes, thank you so much. So I should also maybe add another layer of complexity to this story, which is that I had encountered Michael Fried, as many theater scholars do, through actually his famous anti-theatrical arguments, and specifically through, you know, the infamous, shall we say, polemical work on minimalism, art and objecthood, which you know is often read in theater studies as like, look at how much visual art hates us, which, you know, is, so I had encountered this kind of polemical, you know, the polemical reading of Fried in 1967, but also this polemical reaction, this kind of like reactionary reading in theater studies before. So it was, but you're right that it was when I got into Kopczak that I went back to Fried, and that was when I found that actually there's something very different, I think, going on in his book Absorption and Theatricality than there is in the Critique of Minimalism, you know, which is, again, this sort of polemical piece that says, you know, theater destroys art and must be destroyed to protect art, right? But in Absorption and Theatricality, I think there's a much more complex relationship between theater as an art form and visual art. And of course, that, you know, that's sort of easy to understand if we just remember that his interlocutor and total inspiration in that book is Diderot, who was writing about painting and theater absolutely together. And the whole concept of absorption comes from Diderot's engagement with both theater and painting. So it's really, you know, it's actually, you know, Diderot's famous instruction to actors, act as if the curtain never rose, that is this kind of like central idea of absorption. So that, you know, it was exciting to me both to like dive back into a theorist who I think had been misread in one of my fields of study, but also, you know, to do so with this Kopjeckian frame of actually what we're talking about is something crucial to modern subjectivity. It's actually there's a dynamic here that's really central to subjectivity. So, okay, on the most basic level, for those who haven't read their Freud in a while, right? So the in Absorption and Theatricality, Michael Freud takes absorption as this kind of art historical event in 18th century French painting, where suddenly what people like Diderot, you know, is what we would call an art critic, right, philosopher, and his contemporaries start to, what they start to like in painting is not paintings where figures seem to ostentatiously present their continuity with the beholder's world, but instead, often by, and first, the first example is by turning away from the beholder and towards a diegetic scene, assert their discontinuity with the beholder's world. And that for me is like the crucial thing, is it's like, is the artwork saying I am continuous with your world, or is the artwork in some way expressing its enclosure or discontinuity with the beholder's world? So, you know, of course, we can see how this relates to a certain kind of realist tradition, and certainly in theater relates to, you know, the dramatic realism, the fourth wall, the efforts on the part of realist theater practitioners in the 19th century to create scenes that are that try to forget the beholder, right, in that Diderotian way. And I will hold this up, even though this is primarily a podcast, but right now for the listeners, I am holding up my book cover, which has a picture taken from Joanna Hogg's film, The Souvenir, where the main character, Honor Swinton Byrne, is faced completely away from the camera and is talking on the phone. We only hear these very snippets of conversation that she's having, and we never see her face in this scene. Joanna Hogg constantly, throughout her whole of film scenes where figures turn away from the spectator, scenes where we cannot see the spectator's face, either partially or wholly, scenes where we can only see part of the scene. So there are these incredible scenes in several of her films where we actually overhear what's a narratively crucial conflict, but we don't see it happening. And what we're actually watching is people overhearing it. So we're watching there's this sort of double dislocation of the dramatic scene. And what I realized was that she's doing is working with and reconfiguring in various ways absorption. She's thinking about how to create scenes of absorption, what scenes of absorption can do, and in a kind of exciting, you know, modernist way, you know, she's sort of pushing the boundaries of what absorption is and can do in the films. I should also say that, you know, the aha moment, the light bulb moment, also was realizing that, oh my gosh, we have this magnum opus diptych, The Souvenir, and The Souvenir Part Two, that takes its title and entirely surrounds a painting by Jean-Honoré Fragonard, who is an 18th century French painter who Freud talks about in Absorption and Theatricality. So this was, you know, the label. I was like, okay, I can do this. This is the key to the films. This is the key to The Souvenir films. This is the key to the whole thing. So that was, of course, very helpful. But I also think it's just indicative of the ways that Hogg is deeply engaged with these big questions about realism and modernism and modern art.
Thanks. Just a kind of quick follow-up. I mean, for me as a reader and sort of imagining how to teach this to students in the context of a class, one of the sort of paradoxes you're thinking through is the way this kind of turning away or the closure of a world can somehow be immersive or capture a spectator in an experience that we could describe as immersive. And that formulation of immersion as produced by having figures turn away from us doesn't necessarily square with how our students tend to understand modes of cinematic immersion, or for example, how you know, we would talk about a kind of longer history of political modernist cinema as being antithetical to forms of immersion in like a classic, so-called classical realist text. So I'm wondering if you could just say a little bit more about the sort of counterintuitiveness of yeah. this concept of immersion as produced by the turning away or a form of detachment.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. That's such a great question and a beautiful formulation of this central contradiction. I mean, so there's the like the psychoanalytic answer, right, which has to do with desire and what it is and what Kovcek says, right, is that the theatrical scene, the scene that declares its continuity with us, insists that the other's desire is already known and mastered. It says, I know what you want. You want me. You know, that's what that artwork says, right? And for her, right, that's, you know, and she compares it to the, you know, to the exhibitionist, right? But the idea is that that actually does not create intense attachment. That sort of creates a kind of anxiety and has this kind of aggressive quality, and that it doesn't, rather than, you know, to use a gestural metaphor, rather than make the viewer or the beholder lean in, you sort of lean out. You say, whoa, whoa, you think you're saying you know me. I don't know if you do. So for her, right, psychoanalytically, right, the way that attachment works, what attachment is attachment to the thing you can't grasp. Attachment to, right, and for in her psychoanalytic language, that's the part object of the drive. So by definition, you know, the drive is satisfied by not getting what it wants. Like the drive, you know, you can't grasp it, and that's what the drive is it keeps you going because you can't grasp it. So that's like that would be the Kovcekian psychoanalytic answer. I mean, I think a more Freudian answer. And this, you know, this is what he gets into a bit with his concept of pastoral absorption, right? I think it's a very different notion of immersion and immersiveness than the one that we're used to from like, you know, theme parks, video games. Like it's sort of the opposite actually, because for him, again, the what is immersive is alterity. It is the otherness of the scene that actually, you know, creates the sense that you have to go meet it, right? And that your experience of it involves, the only way is to sort of imaginatively enter it, not actually physically be inside it. Because if you're actually physically inside it, there's no sort of, you know, imaginative, cognitive leap into the scene of alterity. So yes, you're absolutely right. This completely contradicts, you know, the VR notion of immersion, you know, where the whole world is created for you and actually there's no imaginative, leap necessary at all. In fact, imagination is foreclosed by the creation of the world that is total, that is meant to be total. Does that sort of answer your question?
Absolutely. Thanks.
So Shelley, I actually wanted to pick up on a thread, and one of the things I really admired about your reading of Hogg, a pleasant surprise of your analysis, given the hermeticism of these films and the kind of class hermeticism of these films in particular. I mean, they are recursive. They return and again and again to similar family situations, similar upper class, upper middle class families, and their small but occasionally preponderant dramas that seem to be so closed off from the world. In fact, Justice and I were talking yesterday, like we both just rewatched Archipelago recently. And, you know, it's like, you know, these are the only people on the island. There is no world beyond except what comes from this helicopter. But you make a surprising reading, and one that I find very compelling, that Hogg's hermeticism is not apolitical, but politics and maybe in the form of the world intrude upon her films in studied and consistent ways, but you have to look for it. So I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about what it means, like where, how you understand Hogg as a political filmmaker. And I mean, I'm thinking of, like, you know, the bombing of Herod's, or, you know, the character in Archipelago who's going to go to Africa and work with the AIDS crisis. But how the political kind of comes into, maybe intrudes upon the films, but also what it means to read Hogg as a political filmmaker. And maybe you can just take us to a few discrete moments in films that are interesting to you, so we can also bring Hogg back even more prominently into our discussion.
Great. Thank you. Yes, absolutely. Thank you for that question. You know, this is something that really interests me. I mean, in the book, as I talk about this, I really focus on what happens in the souvenir films. You know, something that interests me and is a little curious to me about the widespread critique of Hogg as, you know, being entirely devoid of political consciousness is that she actually includes that critique inside the souvenir films. That's kind of, there's a thematization of that in her, you know, character Julie's naive attempts to make a sort of engagé film as a young film student. And about the docks in Sunderland and, you know, the post-industrial impoverished people there, a desire that is sort of immediately ironized by her lover, Anthony. But that this kind of the problem of what it means for an, you know, upper class white woman to make films about the world at all is kind of thematized there in the souvenir films. So, you know, that doesn't mean that the critique isn't that doesn't invalidate the critique necessarily, but I do think it shows that this is not like something she's never thought about. Actually, it's, you know, it's right in the films as a concern. But for so that's one thing. You know, and the second thing is that as you say, I think that your formulation is really helpful, right? And Hogg has actually said similar things. You know, in her films, the outside world seeps in. So there are these enclosed domestic, you know, often sort of, you know, romantic dyads that are in these films, but the outside world seeps in, and in souvenir films it seeps in the most aggressively, which is a kind of strange thing to say, because it's still these are subtle and withholding films in a lot of ways, as I argue, but there's so much in those films that is actually about the world. You know, there is the whole thing with the IRA that is so important to those films in all these different ways. They're talked about, you know, the scenes with Anthony and Julie's parents, where they're actually discussing political violence and terrorism and IRA terrorism. Of course, the possibly fictive status of Anthony as an employee at the Foreign Office is another way that this sort of this outside world, although this outside world that is also infused with fantasy, is thematized in the films, right? So again, in the way that Anthony's Foreign Office employment, which may or may not be a pure cover for his heroin addiction, right? There may be some truth to it. There may be zero truth to it. That is really left ambiguous throughout, but it is certainly related to his heroin addiction, right? So the whole way that the idea of the outside is connected to this kind of both the real outside of heroin itself, right? Which is in the films, this kind of puncturing of the fantasy of this relationship, but also that is sort of framed as this something that's already digested and presented to us as fantasy, which I think relates again to this whole problem that the film presents us with, which is, you know, how can this character Julie possibly make a film that is not just purely about class fantasy, romantic fantasy, all these fantasies that she has about the world. So that's maybe how I would answer that. I mean, they
I thought what I would do is this is something that Justice and I were talking about too, because I also think what's interesting is where there are discussions of politics, like at the family dining table in various films. I mean, it also shows some other characters, often parents, sisters, who are either are oblivious or just don't care at all. But we were talking a little bit about how the films, you know, flirt with, without ever giving into something like satire. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if there's a relationship between the intrusion of the world politics and something like tone or gesturing towards, but never going in the direction of satire.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, and Archipelago would be a great place to.
That's what we were thinking about. We were thinking about the Edward character and the scene at the dinner table.
Yeah.
And the sisters comment that, you know, they note, both his sister and his mother note his empathy. And then they say something, it's a great line, something like, there's something so aggressive about his empathy or something like that.
Yes. And I mean, but also the whole way that film, again, sets up this, the relationship between the cook, Rose the cook. And Edward, you know, which is this, this flirty relationship, but that also, you know, encodes all this power differential and like all this stuff. And, you know, and the way that we see on the one hand his desire to bridge, shall we say, the class gap between him and Rose is both, you know, sweet and earnest and also completely oblivious and it's self-exploitive. He sort of intrudes on her space in the kitchen and she's like, what are you doing here? It's my job. So there's all this. I mean, I guess, you know, how she keeps it from getting too satirical. It's, I mean, I think she is a master of tone, but it also has to do with what's going on in the acting, right? These are extremely subtle performances developed with the actors who develop a lot of the dialogue. It's not improvised, and she said this, but the actors do sort of collaboratively generate a lot of the dialogue. And there, you know, she creates these setups where, you know, the actors are sort of in situations where they're kind of just exploring what these characters are doing. So it doesn't, I think that when you get actors who are really deeply living inside these realist characters and empathizing with them, actually the question of satire doesn't really come up unless the filmmaker is sort of imposing it through text or something else that suggests tone, if that makes sense, right? So, you know, Hogg lets her actors really set the tone of these scenes in a lot of ways. And I think that that's why we get this, you know, there are certainly laugh lines in Archipelago. There are certainly funny ironies and hypocrisies that we're alerted to. But the characters feel entirely convincing and recognizable, and we have empathy for them as well. So it never tips over into a kind of easy parody.
And there's also this pattern which you indicate with the Rose character, where we see these privileged upper middle class families in a fairly hermetic world, and then we also see the perspective of these outsiders to that world. So I'm thinking about the worker who parks his car in front of the modernist home and exhibition, but you know, the really smart way you read in your reading of The Eternal Daughter, the figure of the hotel attendant and the sort of outside that that figure presents, like the outside of the psychodrama between the daughter and the lost mother. And as I understand it, you see that figure as a way in which, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the fantasy that the central character is engaging in and staging through all these genre tropes is subjected to analysis and critique through the figure of the outside. It's sort of frustrating her ability to stage her fantasy and manage her trauma in the way that she wants. Is that fair?
Yes, that's exactly what I mean. And beautifully. Yeah. So all those, you know, and it's both the sort of the refusal of the attendant to to say yes to all the ways that she wants to manage her fantasy, but it's also that repeated punctuation the attendant in the car with her, you know, presumably boyfriend, with the techno music that is in a generic way, sort of puncturing the gothic drama. It's like, what is this that's sort of entering in and interrupting this aestheticized generic world?
We'll wrap up with, I mean, I have so many other questions, but I'm thinking of maybe asking you, since we're talking about the Eternal Daughter, to talk a little bit about the maternal romance and a few dimensions of this that I think are interesting. I mean, the figure of the mother, which is this through line in so many of the films, but also a relationship between the mother and, you know, mothering and art making, mothers who want to make art, this relationship between creating art and creating life. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about both the autobiographical component of these films in relation to art creation, but what mothering in particular does to bring this to bring these films together in your reading.
Thank you. Yes. So, you know, motherhood is this a kind of, I would say, maybe a shadow theme in the first three films that really comes to the fore in the Souvenir films and the Eternal Daughter, which I think, you know, there is a lot of reason to read the Eternal Daughter as sort of the Souvenir Part Three, right? It's the mother and daughter have the same names, they wear the same clothes. This is, you know, Julie is a filmmaker, and you know, there's a lot of reasons to think about it that way. In the first three films, the first three films are in a lot of ways about a kind of a displaced motherhood, or, you know, in the case of Unrelated, her first film, it's about a desired and foreclosed motherhood. So the theme is always there in these and cuts into the first films in these ways, and then becomes so important to the last three. I think that, you know, what's really interesting, and what at the time critics didn't really note about the Souvenir films, is the extent to which they are about this relationship between mother and daughter. I would say much more than they are about the relationship between the lover and the lovers, the daughter and her lover. The films, you know, begin and end with these scenes of mother and daughter. The question of their relationship, the question of whether, which is sort of, you know, the question of how, to what extent is Julie going to be able to see her mother as an other person and, you know, thus see herself as something separate from her mother, is actually the kind of, I think the real sort of psychological arc of those two films. I think that also, of course, and this is, yeah, something we haven't talked about so much yet, but there's the metatextual resonances of having a mother and daughter play a mother and daughter in those two films. And, you know, Tilda Swinton and Honor Swinton Byrne, and for that to be part of the, you know, part of what we know about the films that's giving them meaning, sort of extra textual meaning. But that we've been encouraged to read the films as being about that in certain ways. So I'm really interested also in the ways that Hogg, in casting the daughter of a close friend, you know, she herself doesn't have children and has talked about this, and that's sort of a theme that comes up in The Eternal Daughter as well. Like, casting a daughter of a close friend, you know, has sort of implicitly cast this a kind of substitute, a different form of maternal relationship through, you know, with the author and the actor, and I think that's a, you know, it's beautiful and moving, but it also, you know, theoretically, again, helps me think about this form of attachment, that is the attachment between the author who has created this world and then put the actor in it, in order for the actor to mess with it or interrupt it, do something other than just fulfill her desire, you know? And that is, I think, a kind of beautiful metaphor for what motherhood should be, right? It's like, I will put you into this world that I will, you know, create to the best of my fantasies, but then I will allow you to completely mess it up and interrupt it and, you know, destroy it even, because that actually is the emergence of subjectivity. So I think there's, you know, I think that the theme is narrative, it's psychological, it seems to be an engine of the ideas in all these films in different ways, and then it kind of launches into this more conceptual level with the final three films.
Shani, we're coming to the end of our time, but I feel like I'd be remiss if I didn't ask. So one of the features of the CFD volumes, as you know, over time has been that we've tried to include an original interview with the director, and we are delighted to have such a terrific interview between you and Joanne Hogg. I'm wondering, at what point in the writing of the project did you have that interview, and if you could say a little bit about what maybe surprised you over the course of that conversation and or shifted your thinking about the manuscript.
Thank you. Yes. So this, you know, this follows in kind of funny personal ways from the last question, because I wrote most of this manuscript while I was pregnant with my second child. So I had this deadline and I had to complete it, but then she made another movie. So again, my fantasy of enclosure and completion was punctured, wholly punctured by the Eternal Daughter. So I had written, you know, most of this manuscript about the first five films, and then this other film came. And it was that turned out to be, you know, a wonderful thing, because it, you know, blew open the whole argument and I think made it much more interesting. And also, you know, really pushed me to, excuse me, think more about the self-reflexive turn in the souvenir films. So, it you know, the Eternal Daughter is in some ways, in lots of ways, you know, the most aesthetically self-conscious of the films, and so I think it actually really helped to make my argument richer and stronger. The arrival of the Eternal Daughter at the New York Film Festival in 2022 was when I knew I might have this opportunity to talk to Hogg, and so that was when I talked to her. So it was I had completed a version of the manuscript that didn't have anything about the Eternal Daughter, and then I got to interview her and see the Eternal Daughter at the film festival, and both of those things really, you know, I was able to take back and work into my reading about the Eternal Daughter. She was incredibly generous and kind, and it was wonderful to talk to her. She also, you know, I think you know, I got the sense she's a very internal and private person, and so that was a moving but also challenging experience for me, because I felt this impulse to not, you know, push and dig and pry in the way that I might with someone with a different affect. And of course, you know, as I think often happens with interviews, and I've experienced this before, you leave and you say, oh, why didn't I ask a follow-up? Why didn't I ask about this? Why didn't I, you know, ask her more to talk about that? So I was relieved and happy that other people didn't feel like the interview was woefully incomplete. I wish I had talked to her more about literary inspiration. I wish I had talked to her directly about Virginia Woolf Into the Lighthouse with Archipelago. You know, there are a lot of things there were so many more wrinkles that I wish I had explored. But the other thing I guess I would just say is that this is the first time I've ever written about a living artist in this way. And that was a really interesting experience too, because, you know, I guess obviously this is what you're doing in this series, but the feeling of, well, I have this whole thing to say about you, but this may not interest you at all. you may not find this resonant with your ideas about your work at all. You know, so that is, there's a certain, I should say, there's, you know, certain anxiety there, but I also sort of had to accept, like, well, this is Shani Enelow's Joanna Hogg. This may not be Joanna Hogg's Joanna Hogg. And that, you know, that's just what it is.
And she seemed like so receptive to that approach. It really does work beautifully as a sort of capstone to to the book. I want to, Shani, thank you so much for being the first in this new venture. And I want to encourage all of our listeners to go out and get a copy of Shani's terrific new book. I also want to note that now that Josh and Sarah are on board, we've been talking together about our editorial priorities moving forward and drawing up a kind of wish list, both of directors that we'd like to see represented in the series, but also scholars and critics that we'd love to write for the series. So I wanted to just ask Josh and Sarah to take a moment and maybe name a few directors that are high on your personal wish list. Josh.
I'm getting pointed to first. Okay. I've loved what the series has been doing over the last decade plus with Jen and Justice leading it in such amazing ways. And also just to note, like what a fantastic pleasure it is to come in on this again. And it's actually taking two of us to stand in for Jen's fantastic work over the last decade with Justice. But we're delighted that you're still in the fold, in the near fold, to help us on this. But I would say in terms of, you know, thinking about continuing to expand and diversify the list and the kind of canon of what we think about as contemporary film directors and who we prioritize in that, the work that you all have been doing so well over the last decade, like, you know, I know that both Sarah and I want to kind of keep pushing in this direction with Justice as we move forward. But for me, one of the top directors I'm hoping to get a volume on soon is Alicia Rohrabacher from Italy, whose, you know, films just, you know, continue to amaze me one after the next. And kind of like Shani's description of kind of some of the beginnings of this project on Hog, like during the pandemic, Rohrabacher's films came to me during the pandemic in a way too. And kind of latching on to her thinking about the world in the ways that she does so incredibly in her films, like, you know, really excited me about, like, hopefully pursuing soon getting a scholar to take up her work, which we're hopefully having the works for the series. So I'll say Rohrabacher is one example. Maybe I'll ask Sarah to jump in now as well.
Well, I completely agree with everything that you've just said. We are in complete agreement both about the amazing direction that it's already started in and continuing that direction, also further diversifying the authors and the directors that we're thinking about. And Rohrabacher, absolutely. I remember when her very short film came out during the pandemic that she made during the pandemic, and I was just so excited that that work was still going on. So yes, let me just echo everything that you've just said, but then maybe also add that we've started talking about, you know, diversifying some of the approaches as well, so that while at the very top of my list would be Céline Sciamma, who I desperately want to see a volume about. She's one of my favorite directors, and I think there's so much reward in looking across a body of work, just to, you know, remind us what Jen was just saying about the political aspects of Joanna Hogg's work, that you have to look for it, right? Like, and you do that because you have all of these examples of different kinds of works that address it in different ways. Well, I think that's incredibly rich. I would also love to see us think about something like experimental work and sort of decentralizing authorship altogether, thinking about maybe a collection of directors who work in similar modes or with similar techniques, rather than a single body of work, to look across bodies of work in the same way that we look across, you know, a body of single work. So I would love to see us explore that possibility. If we had an excellent proposal in that direction, I would be really excited to look at it.
And on that note, you can see, I think, why I'm so excited to be working with Josh and Sarah moving forward. Also, for any prospective authors listening, please feel free to reach out to any of us directly with pitches. You can find guidelines for proposals for books in the series on the CFD website with Illinois Press. I want to thank our friends there, especially Editor-in-Chief Danny Nassett and Christina Stonehill, the digital marketing manager. for all their support of the series and now this podcast. And lastly, I just want to say a special note of gratitude again to Jen. It has been an absolute delight to work with you in this series for a decade now, working with you. And I'm really going to miss it, but I know that you are as excited as I am about our new editors.